Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bokomi. Now, the OMI in Bokomi stands for the original memorable insights that we find in books by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. This week, we're sharing OMI with the award-winning anti-racism activist, educator, entrepreneur, TED speaker, and author who uses her professional background in counselling skills, mental well-being, and human behaviour to encourage meaningful change from the inside out.
Hello, I am Nova Reed, author of The Good Ally, and this is my OMI for Bokomi.
In The Good Ally, a guided anti-racism journey from bystander to changemaker, Nova Reed invites white people to recognise the inherent racism of their culture and to play a more active role in the anti-racism movement.
A lot of people are in pain and suffering in some way or not feeling like they belong, and that can bring up feelings of shame. And if you haven't been able to be with that shame and have support or process it, talk it out, we then start projecting that onto each other.
This is an uncomfortable, original, memorable, insightful book that pulls no punches. It's high time, she says, for white people to confront the ugliness of anti-blackness in Britain's colonial history, to own their shame and move towards a future of mutual transformation and collective healing. Nova, welcome to Bokomi.
Oh, thank you for having me, Richard. Pleasure.
In the book, you look at race relations through a resolutely British lens. Mm-hmm. If it's not too obvious a question, given Britain's involvement in the slave trade, what is it about British culture in particular that makes many people, including Brits, think that we are actually less racist than America or Poland, for instance? Are we, as a nation, in denial?
We are in denial. And I think the reason why we are in denial is for two things. Many people not knowing their history, because there was a lot of collusion with erasing history, throwing documents into the sea and all sorts, as well as people not knowing and not having the desire or curiosity to know. So there's something around, there's a lack in terms of education and knowledge there. And I think there's a huge amount of collective and historical shame, because so much of the harm that has been caused all over the world in terms of enslavement, colonization, and human genocide, Britain has had a firm role in it. And it's a very ugly history, but it's our history. And I think if you're too scared to even look, or you just want to keep up appearances and just ignore it, then it just keeps coming back round and round and round in different formats. So we never really address it or take any sort of accountability so that we can move forward.
We'll move on to shame in a minute, because there's a powerful, powerful point within the book and a scene that runs all the way through the book. But I want to have a little bit of a run-up to it. Talking of Britishness, you took part in a very, very British event.
The Royal Wedding.
Yeah, I mean, you don't get much more British than that. The Royal Wedding, Duke and Duchess of Sussex, Harry and Meghan, back in 2018. Do you think that the country missed an opportunity to move forward with race relations when the couple moved to the USA?
I was sceptical, because there was so much hope that was pinned on poor Meghan, this one individual out of billions, to somehow resolve race relations in Britain. And so I think there was an unrealistic expectation that it would do that. Of course, symbolically, it was very significant what they represented, but they're not the first interracial couple in Britain. And so I found it odd that there was this expectation that just having her there would change things. So I think there was definitely a missed opportunity to improve, do better. I think we've just exposed ourselves. I did a podcast interview probably at the beginning of 2020 with a host in the US. And he is a white man, and he describes himself as a man, whatever that means.
As opposed to a lady man.
He's a man, and he carries a gun, and he used to be part of a sort of evangelical church and had some very He wouldn't have described himself as a right-wing thinker, but he was very right-wing and extreme in his thinking. And essentially turned his life around and realised how racist he was and how much harm he was perpetuating. And so now he's on a mission to bring other men on the journey with him. But at the beginning of his interview with me, he said, you know, I thought race relations were better than they were in Britain. And actually, it's because of their wedding and the subsequent press that they've seen that they realise, wow, didn't realise the racism in Britain was so bad. I think we hide it well.
And the next chapter I want to talk about, which helped me understand why people do bad things, why people are racist, why we feel collectively racist or not, or reject it, is the chapter Grey Matter, Beyond Black and White. And you relate racism to the brain's function and the cognitive inclination to split issues into right and wrong, for and against, black and white, when life is nuanced, yes, and complex and grey. Do you think that social media, which permeates our lives now, has contributed to splitting our collective mind and therefore has contributed to either the exposure or the proliferation of racism in our society?
It, without a shadow of a doubt, has contributed to exposure. Because more people have a voice and more people have a platform. So as a consequence of that, you hear more opinions. But I think where social media gets, or how we use social media is very dangerous, is that it learns what we like. And so, of course, it's teaching us algorithms and it's only showing us content or individuals that we follow who have a similar view to us. And it's dangerous because it informs your worldview and it's not always balanced. And then, of course, you've got, you know, the added trouble where social media platforms need to take more responsibility about information being shared that isn't true, but people believing that it is, and now getting into a state where when they are challenged with fact or presented with fact, they just dismiss it as fake news. And so we just end up not even being able to agree on truth or on fact. And that makes it very difficult to move anywhere. So I don't think that social media has caused us to be divided. We were already divided, we will be until we address it. But it certainly has magnified opinions, voices, behaviours, ideas that are problematic, which just makes the harm go further and wider.
Because the brain is a sorting machine, isn't it?
Yes.
And for good and bad, it helps us have judgment. It helps us seek novelty. It helps us learn.
Yes.
But the paradox to that is that it also recognises difference as perhaps threat.
Yes.
And therefore, when we split things between ourselves, when we see the other, because the brain obviously was formed a couple of, you know, 100,000 years ago in terms of the cognitive revolution. Is there a point in our human history where, let's keep it British. Is there a point where things started to go wrong?
Oh, yes. I mean, just to speak more generally, yeah, our brain is designed to put things in boxes to help, yeah, us process and be able to, you know, be with and interpret the enormous amount of data and information that we get on a daily basis. But, you know, in prehistoric times, that was there to detect danger. And some of us are still stuck in that mode when we see somebody who is other or perceived to be other, who is different to us. So many of us still have an automatic fight or flight response and mistakenly think that they're in danger, and their body is telling them that they're in danger when they're not.
But the point I was trying to get to was that the brain is a lot older than, yes, racism, because racism, yes, is a social construct.
Yes, it is.
It's not actually a natural thing for human beings to do in the brain, because the brain has evolved and developed out of curiosity, and you call for curiosity in your book, The Good Ally. That's one of the tenets and one of the states of mind that helps you be a good ally, is curiosity. But is there a point culturally, say, for instance, colonialism, the empire,
yes,
the East India Company, is there a point where we started going, diverging from natural curiosity to oppression, subjugation, violence?
Absolutely. And you know, there's, you know, historians will pinpoint a century rather than a specific time, because, you know, there's historians are interpreting the information that we have, and so it's open to misinterpretation. But there's lots of evidence around the 15th and 16th century that shows, well, we somehow moved from not judging people by the colour of their skin and interracial relationships being absolutely fine, and communities more likely to judge people or be at war with one another because of religion or tribe, to suddenly it being race. And so for me, the most prevalent that I write about in my book would be in the 17th century, when the Barbados Slave Code and Virginia law, which was embedded by the English, made it law to enslave Africans. So black people were the only community of human beings who've ever been written in law as subhuman and therefore not worthy of human rights. And that was based on skin colour, where people who were black were seen as the most inferior. And that was written in law. And it wasn't just written in law for a couple of years, it's for centuries. And it was the English that wrote that law. And every single country that participated in the slave trade have learned that social construct as well. And of course, we're still experiencing the impact of that.
We use the we there, the kind of general we. I'm talking about all human beings.
Yeah.
That is how we allow ourselves to commit atrocities on other people. And you see that throughout history.
Yes.
By dehumanizing them, because then we don't feel so bad about
yes.
it. I just wonder how it's carried on. But it's obvious because of our roots in trade and our roots, our laws, our constitution. That which makes a country strong and, I use inverted commas there, civilized, is the very heart of the problem, because it's written into our laws. And it takes revolution, it takes violence, it takes upheaval in order to change those laws. And you can say that generally about any law that suppresses or alienates any group of human beings. Mm-hmm. But it's particularly bad with black and brown people, because it sort of never really went away.
It never got dealt with. And that's
no, never got dealt with. Never
that's
got
the essence of what I talk about. It's all well and good having these policies and these law changes. But if culture and mindsets have never been right, how do we undo 300, 400, 500 years of learning, that falsely learning that a collective of human beings is more superior to another purely based on the colour of their skin? Like, how is that being actively and intentionally undressed, unpacked, unlearned? And it hasn't, because we just don't talk about it, which is why it takes on these new mutated formats. And that anti-blackness that was embedded in law and sort of justified by falsified tests and science continues to cause so much harm and dehumanisation, because at the end of the day, human beings aren't made to inflict harm on one another in that way. Mm. Like, it's not a natural state. And so you have to dehumanise someone in order to treat them less than human. You have to, otherwise you can't.
Yeah, well, you share that in common from a point perspective, I think, with Rutger Bregman and his Hopeful History.
Ah.
It shouldn't be revolutionary or counterintuitive, but people are basically good. And that's the hope I got from reading your work. The obstacle we have, it's one thing unlearning something, centuries and centuries of history, and sweeping things under the carpet, just getting on with things. That's one thing.
Yeah.
But when you've got the obstacle, the other human emotion, I mean, humans want to be good generally, by and large, because they want to cooperate. They want to get on with each other. They want to belong.
Yes.
But when you've got the antidote to that, or worse, maybe more like a poison to the belonging being the antidote, the poison of shame, the poison of fear. You describe the chapter Moral Monsters, Racism and Shame, as the most difficult you had to write. And it is incredibly powerful, because it goes straight to the heart of the matter in terms of the obstacles to change. And in it, you articulate the individual's role in the collective consciousness and how our need to belong tips over. You know, empathy is right on the edge, is on the borders of hatred of other people. Please, can you share some of your personal insights on shame and why, as an emotion, it's so closely linked to fear and racism?
Well, shame is a human condition. It is normal to experience shame. When we stay stuck in shame, that's when we get into, you know, unhelpful states, and whether that is impacting our own well-being or whether we project our own shame and start, whether that's through anger or violence or abuse or disengagement with others. If we don't address our shame, it can be absolutely corrosive to ourselves and each other. And I think that's at the root of it. You know, a lot of people are in pain and suffering in some way or not feeling like they belong, and that can bring up feelings of shame. And if you haven't been able to be with that shame and have support or process it, talk it out, we then start projecting that onto each other. And the empathy, and I learned this through Brené Brown, and I when she named it, I was like, it makes so much sense. So the opposite to shame is empathy for ourselves and each other. And if you think about, you know, our shared history in terms of colonization and this, you know, this legalized oppression that went on for so long, and the dehumanization of other human beings, you have to lose empathy as well. So when we start to have conversations about racism and addressing it now, what you're confronted with firsthand is lack of empathy, disengagement. And usually at the root of that, if we strip back the anger and the apathy, usually at the root of that is shame, unaddressed shame. And we've got, you know, there's so much research around epigenetics and what we pass on from generation to generation, and like, we've never dealt with our collective shame. Of course that's going to show up in individual exchanges about racism that feel disproportionate to what's being discussed.
Because people don't want to feel ashamed. And that's the uncomfortable bit of your book for me was, well, it wasn't uncomfortable, it was more revelatory. Trying to explain and have those difficult conversations with people that you care about, because you're sort of, everything's, you're, you know, your amygdala's going crazy. There's, you know, cortisol is flooding your brain and everything's going against, because you don't want to dislike people you care about and you know that they're good people. But it's a sort of revelatory moment. It's because they don't want to feel bad about themselves. Outside of my liberal bubble, in another world, people feel bad about stuff, and they don't like to be reminded of it.
Yes, yes.
And it's made me understand a bit more compassionately why someone would feel like that.
Yes.
But that's the collective side of it. And we're kind of making light of it because that's a mechanism of dealing with it as well.
Yeah.
It did make me understand a bit more that I'm not superior to the people that I was disagreeing with, because that's the problem with social media. That's the problem with splitting. That's the problem. We go, right, well, they're just a
I'm right, they're wrong, I'm good, they're bad, or whatever it might be. It's very binary, and that's that's something I talk about in the book and with my anti-racism students, right, when they get stuck, or I've tried to have a conversation with my family and they're not getting it and I feel rubbish or whatever it might be, and I said, how are you approaching the conversation? And sometimes with people who are at a different stage with their understanding, if you just go in and say you're bad and telling them what to do, they're just going to shut down and go into a state of defense and they can't listen. And if it's family, I found, and it depends on the circumstance, sometimes going in with curiosity means you're able to just continue the conversation rather than trying to change their minds in one exchange. It's a journey, because it's, you know, it's confronting. They're hearing you say, they're hearing you tell them that they're a right-wing extremist.
Yeah. And to my shame, I did shut it down, to my, because I panicked a little bit.
Yeah. And we do. And like, I still do. Like, I'm in this work. I do. And there's sometimes where I'm not as eloquent as I would like to be, or I'm just tired and exasperated. And you know, there's a different layer when you're trying to debate your humanity as a black person with somebody who is racialized as white or isn't black. There's a different layer to it. When it's family, like, at the end of the day, they're people that you love and you want to bring them on in this journey, and that means it's got to be more than one conversation.
You've got to put the time in,
trying to understand a bit more about where they're coming from and why they find views which are harmful, why they're upholding them.
Keeping on the lighter note, did you ever see the Avenue Q stage show?
Everyone's a little bit racist.
I
can't can't remember the tune.
I think that's it. It's a sort of Sesame Street thing, isn't it? I went to see that years ago when it was kind of second year in New York. Your book reminded me of that experience. It was a very sort of liberal New York audience and we all felt a little bit smug. What's really clever about that, about Avenue Q, is it allowed people actually to have that conversation without shutting down. I mean, I think it was, again, it was of its, everything's of its time, isn't it? But how did you feel when you saw it?
Well, I had a friend who was in it at the time, so I guess I was there just to support him.
Well, you had to like it then.
But it was tongue yeah. in cheek. It's a great show. And like, it wasn't telling me anything new.
No, it wasn't trying to, wasn't preaching in any way, was it?
No.
Just it was entertainment. Wait, so you head up the chapter on shame with a quote from Brené Brown. Mm-hmm. Shame corrodes the very part of us that believes we are capable of change. And you go on to quote her as saying, shame makes us feel unworthy of love and belonging. We've talked about that, and unworthy of connection. Mm. How does it feel to you when white people want to share their shame about racism with you?
Oh, it's very problematic. It's painful. It's painful. I think it's very different if you're in relationship with somebody who, and I don't mean like a intimate relationship, but you have a relationship and they're a friend or they're someone in your life, because there is an element of consent that needs to happen and a rapport where they know whether that's okay or not. So there's someone in my life, and she had an experience and it brought up some stuff for her. And she, particularly, she's white, and she said, a load of stuff's come up about this, and I'm feeling X, can I talk to you about it? And I didn't have the capacity, and I said no. She was okay with that, and so she, you know, she went elsewhere. So I think with relationship, there just needs to be communication and consent, but otherwise, it's harmful. It's really, really harmful, and that was really magnified in summer 2020 last year, the resurgence of BLM and the murder of George Floyd, where so many black people in particular were just not coping with the amount of white friends who were suddenly wanted to just almost excavate their guilt and shame onto them by, you know, as a means to try and make themselves feel more comfortable and be soothed by another black person. You know, even that move in itself is racist, because it's not our responsibility to soothe.
During that period, 2020, yeah. post George Floyd's murder, that uncomfortableness and that, as you say, white people projecting their shame onto you, expecting some kind of absolution. You say you felt like a Catholic priest receiving confession. Who are the most, you know, who were seeking absolution for their sins?
It was a big mix, and it was, and from people that I hadn't heard from or had any dialogue with for years. And so it was extraordinary because of that, because it wasn't like we're in connection with one another on a regular basis. It was just out of the blue. Some people were colleagues who had my mobile number because we've worked together in the past, and so there's not really a relationship there other than work. So it felt very extractive, and it was random things, from people telling me about things that happened at an event and they heard someone say the N-word and they didn't say anything, and right through to, oh, well, I didn't realise, and I just need you to, can you pick up the phone? I want to talk to you. Like, no. But underneath all of that, like, they've forgotten that I'm a human being and a black woman, and that I was also suffering.
So if they'd said, are you okay, you know, with what's going on? How do you feel? That was not offensive.
Acknowledgement. I mean, again, it depends on the relationship.
Yeah,
I think
it's context, isn't it?
It's context. And also people approaching the subject with integrity. So if I hadn't spoken to this person for 3 years, which was the case with one of these people that came, it could be approaching the subject like, I'm aware of what's going on. I've seen what's happened with George Floyd. I'm aware of what you do for work, and also that you're a black woman. I'm also acknowledged that we haven't spoken for 3 years.
Yeah, you've got to acknowledge that.
And I've been thinking of you. Like, do you see what I mean?
My black alarm phone's going off.
Oh my! But that's what it felt like. And you know, there's the everyday racism. There's the everyday racism.
once I'd sort of got into my uncomfortable seat with your book, that's why I actually started enjoying it. And you start sort of shuddering slightly because you can think of times when you've seen it happen or you've been involved. You compassionately through the book go, look, this isn't a test. And, you know, this isn't how less racist can I be than someone else. You know, it's not a competition.
Yes.
It's a sort of acknowledgement. It's an awareness. And I think that's where your training as a, you know, in terms of human behavior comes in. And that's what's original and memorable about the book. Everything has that pivot, that mental, human, neurological pivot and about people's well-being. And you place yourself very firmly in the middle of that. You know, you're not saying, I am the most self-aware person in the world and I never make mistakes.
Oh my God. I said that. I think I wrote that on a social post. I can't actually remember. Days are blurring right now. At some point this week, that I just feel, you know, writing a book is one thing because you're so close to the content. It's yours. No one else really has it other than your agent and your editorial team. And then suddenly it's not yours anymore. It's everyone else's to judge, to love, to loathe, to critique. And when I wrote it, I never intended to make it as autobiographical as I did and to share so much of myself in it. But that's what needed to come out. And I said, like, it's the same with the people that I'm working with. I can't teach or, you know, have dialogues about racism, anti-racism in particular, in any meaningful way without acknowledging my own healing, my own challenges with internalized racism and anti-blackness as well. Like, I can't see how you can meaningfully do anti-racism education and ignore that part. And that applies to anyone who's teaching it, regardless of their background. Like, you've got to acknowledge your stuff. But it was when I really took a deeper dive into history. It's like, we keep, you know, and it was generally history in general. Like, we keep hearing about Dr. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Like, what were the women doing? Like, I want to hear about the women. Yeah, like, where were they? And so in researching what women were doing during this period, and I meant women across the board, I then started finding out, oh my goodness, so much violence because they were under the oppression of men during that time and experiencing dehumanization because of that. And I think I have a subtitle. I don't think I have a subtitle called Hurt People, Hurt People. And so I really thought it was important to dissect patriarchy and its impact around that time on white women and therefore the impact that white women had on black people because they were often gifted enslaved people in place of money or property because they didn't have access to it. And there was a lot of control and violence and manipulation and jealousy. It's dark. It is what it is. And I thought, we have to shine a spotlight on this.
And standing by while those things happened, and you see it happening time and time again in history, and we've got it in Kabul at the moment, or it's about to bubble over, where you have an oppressive state and people to protect themselves point the finger elsewhere. I'm studying World War One and Two at the moment and the horrific things that went on in the Holocaust. Yeah. And how we are still saying, how did that happen? Do you think, whether it's a gender or a culture or a group of people, do you think collectively there are examples where people have effectively dealt with the shame of their ancestors, their direct ancestors, Germany in the Holocaust, for instance? What can we learn from them?
I use Germany as an example because there is information, there is research, and there is data and evidence to show what they've done in terms of atonement and reparations to Holocaust survivors and their family. You know, but I guess the reason why I also brought Germany into it is because that Germany invited, I've been to Germany to do some work a lot, and I remember, I think it was when I was doing my TED talk in Frankfurt, just having dialogues with some of the locals, and the ease, Richard, of which we were just talking about racism. It was easeful. There was none of this discomfort or defensiveness or denial. Like, they acknowledged
their cultural role in that. And they said, oh, well, you know, in our schools, it's taught and we talk about it and the children know about it. So there's this openness. And the thing about addressing shame and releasing the burden of shame is talking about it. And Brits don't do that, generally speaking. And just imagine what that looks like collectively. And also just in terms of the World War, the Second World War in particular, you know, all of the separation that happened where children were split from their families and sent away from cities to, you know, to the countryside with people who weren't vetted to be foster parents, and the abuse that went on there, and then finally returning to their family several years later to a bomb-ridden London, to family members that were no longer there. I wish I could bring it to mind, but you can probably find it if you want to link to it. But there's research that shows the government actively encouraged people not to talk about it.
Yes.
Yeah. That's in our culture.
Yeah.
And it's corrosive to our very being.
And it permeates society at every level, doesn't it? Into economically and socially and culturally.
Yeah.
It's that kind of, but it is in its lighter term, the stiff upper lip.
Yes.
In parochial terms to the UK. Generally, talking to children, I talk to my children about race, and they're much better at recognising racism than I was growing up.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't ever use the phrase white privilege or call anyone in or out or anything when I was growing up. Do you look at kids today and see hope, or do you see them growing further apart from each other because of social and economic divisions? Well, how do you feel about the future?
I look at children and see hope, and some of the most wonderful conversations I've had have been with children, because they're not wrapped up in shame and guilt and defensiveness. Mm. They're just curious souls, and you can have a dialogue. So I'll share one example. I was with a friend, and her daughter must have been about 7 years old, and she got really excited when I came round, and she wanted to show me a book that she'd been reading, and it was about Rosa Parks, and I asked her to share the story with me, and so she did. And as she was sharing the story, she said, oh, something like, you're coloured, aren't you? And I said, well, what colour is my skin? And then she said, brown. And I said, it's okay for you to call me brown or black. But coloured is a word that was used a long time ago that was really, really hurtful to people. So we can use these words instead. And she's like, okay. And then she carried on telling me her story, and she used the word brown. So I have lovely conversations with children, and there's a curiosity and an openness. They don't have the same weight and baggage that we do as adults. And the experience I share in my TED Talk and in my book, when I was walking to school and I was pointed at and likened to feces by a young girl, she asked her mum why I was the same colour as poo. And the reason why that has stuck with me and has, you know, formed so much of the bedrock of what I do now, it wasn't the child's curiosity. Of course, that was exposing and shameful, and I'd already started learning that my value as a human being was less. I'd internalised a lot of stuff already.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand what racism was then, but I knew that my value as a human being was less. It wasn't her. It wasn't that it was her mother's response.
Right.
And her mother ushered her away from me like I was contagious, like I was dirty.
Right.
And it was that response that I remember the most, and that caused, the most harm.
Interesting.
Yeah. But because children pick up on nonverbal cues from as young as 7 months old. So I was 7 at that point, and I could see, even though the mum didn't say anything, her behaviour was speaking volumes to
Absolutely.
Me.
Back to what we said at the top of the conversation, which gives us all hope. If you want to not be depressed in life, you have to take this step, but people want to be good.
Yeah.
So when you see someone not taking the opportunity to be good, to right a wrong, it's a physical sensation, isn't it? Because you know, I've had similar in as a kid, not similar to your experience. I mean, I have had a situation where I've seen a wrong not righted. It affects kids. It's an opportunity to change the course of that kid's future.
Yes.
That's being a sensitive, sentient, intelligent kid. That's what hurt you, isn't it?
Yes.
That's it's that what the, somehow the universe is not what it should be.
Yes.
And yeah. actually the universe is what it should be because people generally, we come through things, don't we?
And yes.
We do,
and people
through.
Want to come through.
People
things.
Want
like,
to.
No,
yeah.
no one enjoys yeah. suffering. Like no one enjoys that. No one wants that state constantly. I see this as opportunity, but I always say, like I frame anti-racism work, and so do some of my colleagues, is collective healing. And if you've ever been through any kind of therapy, or you've had an injury, or you've broken a bone, like sometimes it's painful and it feels worse before it gets better. But on the other side of that. Is transformation in some way.
So finally, we're obviously capable of imagining a better future together because we build things, we create things, we do good things. What is the one thing that the listener can do today to be a change maker tomorrow?
Have the courage to be honest and vulnerable. Because I think if most of us are honest with ourselves, we already know what our isms are and what they look like. And knowing what they are and what they look like is the first step, because then we can start to make a conscious and intentional choice to do something about it and be kinder human beings to one another. But we have to look at it and we have to be honest.
Nova Reid, thank you for sharing your OMI with BookOMI.
Thank you.
Nova's book, The Good Ally, A Guided Anti-Racism Journey from Bystander to Changemaker, can be purchased from our independent bookselling partner, Primrose Hill Books. Just follow the link in the episode description. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Bye for now.